Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. Thank you for coming back. We are in Zechariah 14, hoping to make some more ground in chapter 14. And I do want to read some more verses that I wrote about last week, or wrote down last week, to kind of overlap it. Because surely this is going to be, this is not just a one-time event here in Zechariah. It's referred to probably repeatedly throughout Scripture. I'll read right off the notes. I'm going to just read through. I've got chapter 14, verses 1 through 15 in the English Standard Version on the notes, and I'm just going to read through that, and then we'll go down and break those down and look at a few references. Chapter 14, verse 1, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half the city shall go into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. On that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, by a very wide valley, so that half the mount shall move northward and the other half southward. Verse 5, "And you shall flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach Azel. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. On that day there shall be no light, cold or frost, and there shall be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light." So it sounds like it's going to be dusk, kind of like, and that's an interesting thoughts there. "On that day living waters shall flow out of Jerusalem," and that probably refers to just fresh waters. Again, you could go spiritual like Ezekiel, and that's probably the same waters, but the idea there is year-round, there's water's going to be bubbling out. It's fresh water coming out, like if you want to say sparkling water as it's moving, not just stagnant water, but not necessarily, you know, spiritual water. "On that day, living water shall flow out of Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in summer as in winter," which will be unique because there's two seasons. There's the winter. We have four. They've got two, basically. The winter, and then the summer season. The winter is when their water is flowing. In the summer, the wadis are dried up. And so this will be unique. It'll be a source of water that's filling the streams or the wadis year-round, which, of course, will change the environment. "And the Lord will be king over the earth on that day. The Lord will be one and his name one. The whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's winepress. And it shall be inhabited, for there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord shall strike all the peoples with that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. And on that day a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of the one will be raised against the hand of the other. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem," and that's again picking up out of 12, "and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold, silver, and the garments in great abundance. And a plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and whatever beast may be in those camps." So what we have here is, again, that event. One commentator made the comment that however you interpret this, if you want to find out how someone interprets the Bible, how they view the Scriptures, have someone explain this to you. And you're going to have to go figuratively, like, well, this is figurative, or have it find some historical meaning to it. Or you're going to have it be like a literal fulfillment. And I think the very fact that the Lord is on the Mount of Olives, and we've got it tied together with Acts chapter 1, where his feet, he's standing on and leaves, his feet are going to be on the Mount of Olives, that we're talking about a literal fulfillment. That's why when we talk about the water that flows, the living water, you could go all spiritual, but it's like that means literally, in the sense, it's fresh water that's coming up out of the ground, out of the streams. It's coming out of the Temple Mount. And again, Ezekiel picks up on that. So let's go to the notes and go through these and then look at some other verses. Again, page 1, Zechariah 14:1. Behold, the day is coming for the Lord. This is a day, and again, for the Lord, which it's going to separate this from, you know, a normal day, like a day of man or a day of the God of this age, any normal day. This is going to be, it's going to say later on, this is a unique day. I wrote down here, the day is for the Lord's benefit and purpose, meaning he is going to execute his will. He's going to do it for himself. Again, point B, it's opposite from the man's day or the fallen age ruled by Satan, the god of this age. And it's a day that the Lord takes charge to do his work and to do it his way. So I would say, you know, the day for the Lord, that this day has, you know, that God is always working his plan. God is always in control. But he's also working with man and man's plan. Satan's doing his work and God's using Satan and what Satan's trying to do. In this time, it's like God is shutting it down and he's now going to have his day. It's a day for the Lord. And the next thing, when it says day, and again, you don't have to agree with these things. I mean, I'm teaching. You've got the text. You've got your own mind. You've got other teachers. So you can consider this. This day is not a one day. It's again, you're going to see these events. It's more than 12 hours or 24 hours. It's like all these things are not just be crammed together. We got to have it done before the sun sets. This is would be more like an event, a period of time. Now again, we're not talking about years, but you've got to be able to get all this, especially when it starts talking about in the winter and summer. I mean, you're spreading this time out where you're going to have more than just a day. So that's point one. A day is used here, refers to more than 12 or 24 hours. And point three, it says, Jerusalem will be plundered. The Jews are defeated and so overwhelmed that the plunder, the spoil, is taken from them and will be divided in the presence of the conquered people. So what we have, as we'll see this again in a moment, apparently the nations are gathered at Jezreel, at Armageddon. They march on Jerusalem, and they take Jerusalem. Jerusalem is taken by the nations. Now again, if you read right here in the next verse, chapter 4, verse 2, this is not like, uh-oh, Satan's in control, because it says right here, first of all, this whole chapter is begins with, a day is coming for the Lord. This is the Lord doing his work. And what he does is he's going to gather all the nations in the Valley of Armageddon. We see that with the demons going out and gathering the kings. Now, the demons are doing it, but they're doing it under God's allowance. And once they're gathered here, he is going to bring them to Jerusalem. So God is bringing the nations to Jerusalem. And then the spoil will be taken from you and divided in your midst. Jerusalem will be taken, or it will fall. The plunder will be taken. They're going to go house to house. They're going through the house. And we're going to read in a moment, half the people are going to be taken into exile. Half the people are still in the city watching their possessions be divided among them. They're watching their plunder be divided. And it says, when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. If that means what it means these nations, Armageddon, have marched on Jerusalem. Now this separates it, like we said last week, from Gog and Magog. The Gog, and because they are destroyed in the mountains environmental, I mean storms, earthquakes, by the hand of God. There's no real battle. They just fall on the mountains, and Israel goes out and collects the dead bodies. Here, they invade Jerusalem. Jerusalem is taken. It falls. Half the city is into exile. There's plunder being taken. And the next verse says, for I will gather all, this happens because I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off or killed, destroyed, or removed from the city. So that half here now becomes your remnant. They're the ones that are always talked about, the remnant that remains. Now, why this happens, why this half is taken, why the plunder takes place, we mentioned it last week. It must be some kind of discipline. It is, and I'm going to show you the verses here. It is the end of the age of the Gentiles. The age of the Gentiles, apparently, would say, that begins with Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold. Jerusalem falls, and Jerusalem begins to be trampled on by the Gentiles in 586 B.C. The age of the Gentiles continues through the Persians, the Greeks. It comes all the way up to Rome. Jesus spoke about it. He says, Jerusalem, I'll read the verse here in a moment. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the age of the Gentiles is fulfilled. And he's saying when it's going to be surrounded, it's going to fall. That would include 70 A.D. Jesus spoke that in 30 A.D. 70 A.D., Rome comes in. And that wasn't the beginning of the age of the Gentiles. I mean, you could say, like I said, I'm teaching this, so you can say, well, I think it begins with the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar goes all the way down through until that stone that is cut out, not by human hands, strikes the statue. Now, notice that statue decreases in value, as you know, gold, silver, bronze, and then the iron, and then eventually clay. And then what is the kingdom of God? It's a rock. I mean, it's almost like, I was thinking about it the other day. It's almost a rock. Well, that's like caveman. That's Neanderthal. We're going backwards, and it becomes a mountain that covers the whole earth. Now, again, I'm not sure if there's any meaning, but you go from gold all the way down, and what takes out that statue is a rock that's going to become a mountain. But nonetheless, it began the age of the Gentiles. It's going to continue to the 70 AD. It continues through the church age. It has to include 1948. It has to include the age of the Gentiles today. And it has to include Zechariah chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, because it's going to say right here, Jerusalem is going to be trampled. It's going to be walked on. Let's see. Let me read the next verse, chapter 14, verse 3, and we'll come back to 2. The Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. And at that point is when he interrupts. And Jerusalem is being trampled on in chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, until chapter 14, verse 3, which it doesn't say, and thus ends the age of the Gentiles. But at that point, in chapter 14, verse 3, the Lord comes back, rescues Jerusalem, and it now is never going to be trampled on again. And so I think that is the ending of the age of the Gentiles up through, I've got 1948, I've got today, and then Zechariah 14, verse 1 and 2, and then right there, that is your period of the age of the Gentiles. Of course, that's debatable. You don't have to agree with that. But that would be, once that takes place, it's never going to be trampled on again. Going back to chapter 14, verse 2 on page 1, for I'll gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken. Point one, this day for the Lord begins with the Lord gathering the nations against Jerusalem in 14:2. The nations are mentioned four times in Zechariah 14. I've got them written down here just so you know. The nations play big in this. And these are some clues we're going to be looking for. The nations, when we look at the other references to this battle at the end, the nations are all going to be involved. It wasn't the Roman invasion in 70 AD, because that was the Roman Empire. It's not Gog and Magog. That's a very specific nations are mentioned. And the battle doesn't go the same way. So that's not the same battle. It's anywhere the nations are. And I think now we're getting into Revelation, where the nations are going out against Jerusalem. The nations have been deceived. And then you wonder, everybody thinks they're living in the end times. And I mean that. I mean, the disciples were looking for the return of the Lord. The crusaders, wherever you're at, they're looking for the return of the Lord. But you can imagine what we're doing in our culture and our world today. Are we moving? It's like history's moving this direction. So even if, you have no Bible verse, we're moving this direction. But are we seeing signs of the nations uniting in an effort that is eventually going to lead to this kind of a coming against Jerusalem? It appears Jerusalem at this point is standing against this unified world. It also appears that within Jerusalem are two groups. I say this, carefully. This half seems to be removed, destroyed. God is gathering them, and his purpose is to destroy Jerusalem like he did, 586, 70 AD, or other times where he brought judgment on Jerusalem. But then at some point, some reason, he comes back and delivers this half. So I think we can assume that when Jerusalem, during this time period, if you want to talk about the 70th week, again, I'm being speculating, but they're not a unified front any more than the United States of America right now is a unified front. You think, look at what America is doing. It's kind of like, wait. America's doing that, this particular, political party or this particular branch of the government, but it's not what I would do or what this group thinks. There's different groups within America. This Jerusalem, these Jews at this time will have signed a peace treaty with the Antichrist 7 years before, thinking or assuming he is the Messiah, the one that is going to give them their place in the nation. And again, we've said that before. We're thinking about Jesus coming back, the Messiah coming out of heaven. They're thinking of Cyrus, a Gentile who gives them permission to rebuild their temple. And so they're looking for another man like Cyrus. Christians are looking for Jesus Christ returning. And so when they sign this treaty, there's going to be a group of them that is going to sign with the Antichrist. But there's going to be some that are like, no, don't do this. They may be believers, or they may be against this idea, looking for maybe a more biblical fulfillment. Then during this time of testing, Jacob's trouble, they're going to start to branch off into different sections, maybe even switching alignments, who they're aligned with. Some of them may have agreed with the ideal of the Antichrist, but definitely at the halfway point, when he enters their temple, sets himself up, Jesus says, when you see that, flee, because it's going to get bad. So many of those that maybe signed up with the Antichrist halfway through are going to be going, oh my gosh, no. And they're going to change their mind and start looking for the Messiah. And of course, we've already seen that in Zechariah 12. They'll look at the one they pierced and recognize that, and they're going to mourn for him. It's like, we have made a terrible mistake. And so that's taking place here in Jerusalem. This is not a unified front. Consider this, as you approach this, and again, it's similar to 70 AD. There was divisions, and I said it probably last week because I've been reading about it in a book, but before Rome got there, before Pompey got there in 63 BC, the Jews were fighting each other, and Pompey came in to stop the civil war. Rome set up their peace by force, put Herod in place. Herod ruled. Everybody thinks Herod's evil, and Herod was a man of the age, a man of the world, but he kept peace in Israel. He kept it. He ruled it. When he died, chaos broke out, and it got stabilized by the Romans. But the Jews, by the time 65, 66 AD came, the Jews were fighting. They had already found their own new messiahs, and they were fighting in Jerusalem. When Vespasian approached, the Jews had to stop fighting each other to fight the Romans. But even when the Romans would take a day off or regroup or build up kind of siege engines, the Jews would resume fighting against each other in the city in 66 up to 70 AD. Even the last month, they were still fighting. Whenever they had a chance, they were fighting against each other. So it would be unusual to think that this is a unified front of Jerusalem when the nations are approaching, that all these Jews are standing together, except they're probably standing against the nations. There's probably division among them. And that may explain what's taking place here, why half of them are being disciplined, but the other half are going to be delivered and become the remnant, and we're going to see an earthquake is going to form, and this remnant is going to flee to the east in an earthquake. Like Moses parts the Red Sea, the Lord is going to part the Mount of Olives and lead them out of the city of Jerusalem on their day of deliverance. So that's kind of setting these things up. These are things we're looking for when we read Revelation and other end time prophecies of the Lord's return. Even Paul's references in the New Testament, especially Jesus, when he's talking to Matthew 24 or Luke 21, we're talking about a remnant of people that God is coming back to deliver. We're talking about nations coming together. Here, we're seeing Jerusalem being crushed, plundered. The women are being raped, but then it stops, and now there's a great deliverance. Point one on page one, The nations are mentioned four times in Zechariah 14. Chapter 14, verse 2, "For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle." Chapter 14, verse 14 is going to say, now watch the switch. By chapter 14, verse 14, "The wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected by the Jews." In chapter 14, verse 2, their plunder in the city of Jerusalem after it's fallen is being divided in front of them. The Lord returns, and by chapter 14, or verse 14, 11, 12 verses later, the Jews are dividing the plunder of the nations. So, I mean, there's a huge swing in this chapter. And you can't deny it. The Lord is bringing the nations down. There's a crushing defeat of Israel, but the Lord returns, and there's a completely 180 degree. It's like Michael Jordan shows up and plays on your high school team. It's like, wow, we're really good now. Okay, yeah, Michael showed up. So this is, Jesus is kind of like the Michael Jordan of religion, I guess. Or wait, Michael Jordan's like the, well, anyway. I was trying to be funny there. Okay. When I'm funny, laugh or something. It's like, okay, thank you, okay. Okay, if I think I'm funny, laugh, okay. I should have a laugh sign. Okay. Chapter 14, verse 16. "Then everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths." So everyone that survives, see, these nations are coming. The nations, their military will be defeated, but there's going to be survivors from all those nations, and they're going to come up and worship. So you can see we've gone from the nations invading to the nations' plunder being taken from them to the survivors have now switched and agree now. They're coming up to worship, and again, some of them by force because it's being ruled with an iron scepter. And then chapter 14, verse 19, "This shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that do not go up to the feast and worship." And so you've got the nations coming against Jerusalem. You've got the nations' plunder being divided by the Jews. You've got the survivors coming up to worship. But eventually, some of the survivors are going to say, "We're not going up to worship." Well, there's a punishment coming, and this is in the millennium. This is in the kingdom age. Again, you can tell how I view eschatology and how I view the Bible. One, I'm reading this literally, like it's actually going to happen. And I'm viewing the Bible not as something that is written down as a motivational speech or something that's written down after the fact, but something that's written down by the inspiration of God with a prophetic element talking about events that have not yet happened. Again, and I think, of course, that's the correct way, but there's other ways of approaching this. Like this is just imagery, or it's a historical fact, or it's just poetry, or, you know, it's, you know, just fiction by some prophet they named Zechariah, and he never really lived. Someone just wrote it down and slapped someone's name on it. Again, there's different ways of looking at it. But those are the four places the nations are going to be mentioned. So in the nations, throughout this chapter, they begin coming against Jerusalem, and as we go into the millennium, they're going to be part of those that are worshiping in Jerusalem. Chapter, point 1b, and Revelation 16, verses 14 and 16, this is, I think, a very direct connection to this. Revelation 16, verse 14 through 16, "For they are demonic spirits." That's the demon that comes out of the mouth of the prophet, the false prophet, and the dragon. "For they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God Almighty." Now, you notice that. I've got that in bold print. Great day of God Almighty. That, I think, is, when I had it written up here, a day for the Lord. In Zechariah chapter 14, verse 1, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord." I think the day that is coming that is for the Lord is, in Revelation 16, 16, the great day of God Almighty. I think those are the same days. Again, that's making a connection. Or verse 14. "And they assemble them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon," or Har Megiddo, the hill of Megiddo, which is in the time that John was writing, Har Megiddo, it was is a dome or a tell, T-E-L, which is an ancient ruin that has just become a mound. And that today it's been excavated. They've dug down. They've done a hole in the early 1900s. They spent years excavating through the different layers. I don't know. Is it 14 different layers that they've got? They're going way back to the Canaanites. And there's a Canaanite altar from the days of Abraham sitting there. They excavated down. They went through the age of, the Crusaders. They went through the age of the Byzantine. They went through the age of Solomon, went all the way down to the Canaanites. But in John's day, it was a tell or a mound. A har means mountain of Megiddo. It's right on the edge of the Jezreel Valley, but it was the city of Megiddo, and it was the hill, the tell, the mound of the city of Megiddo on the Jezreel Valley. So the valley of the hill of Megiddo. Okay, they're being gathered there by the Lord. Okay, that's that point. Point two on page one, Jerusalem falls to the nations. I think we've said all these things already. Point three, there it is. I was talking about the age of the Gentiles. There's that information there at the bottom of page 1.3. Turn the page. I've got Luke 21 written there. Bottom of page 1, the very last line. This is Luke 21:24. This is the eschatological chapter, just like Matthew 24 is the end times that Jesus is teaching. Luke does it in verse chapter 21. And again, we'll compare them. We have before. But it's Jesus says, they, referring to the Jews, will fall by the edge of the sword, referring to 70 AD. If we go back and read this, he's talking about predicting that they're going to fall in 70 AD, and be led among the nations, and that would be they're dispersed among the nations in 70 AD, but that has continued throughout this age. In 70 AD, the Jews have been scattered among the nations. And then he says, and I've got it underlined, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. That's what we're seeing right here, Zechariah 14, 1 and 2, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And when are the times of the Gentiles fulfilled and Jerusalem stops being trampled? Zechariah 14, 3 is where I think this stops. And again, I got Luke 21, 24 because that's when it was written. And now we have chapter 14, verse 3, I think the ending of the age of the Gentiles. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. Again, interesting. You've got to put this in your theology. The Lord gathers them. Well, it says the Lord gathers them at Jerusalem. It says it very clearly. But if we correlate this with Revelation, it's demons coming out of the mouth of the false prophets, the Antichrist, and the dragon that go off with signs and miracles and deceive the nations to come to Jezreel to gather at the Valley of Armageddon with the intention of fighting Jerusalem. So now you've got the Lord gathering the nations, but as he's doing it, he's using the puppets of the demonic world to do what they think is their will. But it's like, yeah, I can use that. And he brings, they're doing his will, to come against Jerusalem. Remember, the Lord destroyed Jerusalem in 586, but it was who? It was Nebuchadnezzar. And then who got punished for it? Nebuchadnezzar. So again, they've got their own worldly plans or demonic plans. God allows them to take place and uses them to fulfill his will. So you've got here the Lord using satanic forces to bring the nations together. He says he's gathered them together to bring them to Jerusalem. He uses them to destroy Jerusalem again, 586, 70 AD. And on this day right here, they begin to do it again. In fact, they've taken the city. They're plundering the city. And then he says, okay, we're done here. This is what I wanted to accomplish. He intervenes, lands on the Mount of Olives, or comes to the Mount of Olives, and we talked about it last week, and switches a 180 degree, and now he's fighting for Jerusalem. And that's where we're at in chapter 14, verse 3. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. Again, I put this in here because it's worth mentioning, especially in our soft, fluffy age of postmodernism and too much testosterone, people think. The Lord is a warrior and will engage in physical battle with the militaries of the nations. It's going to be a physical, militant interaction by Jesus Christ when he comes and destroys the nations. He's going to need some men on the scene. Okay, he's not going to come back some soft, postmodern, transgender, you know, let's bring peace to everybody. Everybody's got their own opinion. We're all okay. He's going to come back with getting ready to rule. And there's another thing to throw in your theology. When Jesus begins to rule from the book of Genesis all the way through, the ideal is he's going to rule with an iron scepter. is not going to be a democracy. Now, that's hard for me to swallow, being Go America, Constitution, the Bill of Rights. In this age, that's where I'm at. But when Jesus comes back, there's no, in a sense, Bill of Rights, a declaration. There's no Constitution. There is shut up and sit down. This is the way it's going to do. Well, that's not what we want to do. Fine. It says right here in this chapter, you get no rain. I'm going to send you a plague. And then you'll change your mind and listen. It's like, whoa, that don't sound very Christ-like. That's exactly Christ. That's the Messiah. It's like, well, that's not who I follow. Okay, well, then you better do some heart searching, because that's who's coming back. It's like, well, our church doesn't follow a Lord like that. I know. That's the problem. That's what I've been trying to say. It's like, let's get back to the Bible and meet Jesus. Well, he offends us. Okay, I mean, I think my case is over here. We've done our job. Okay, but anyway, I point that out. The Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights in the day of battle. Now, again, we are in the age of grace. He's offering grace. He went to the cross to pay for the sins of the world. But notice, he didn't go to the cross, and then God says, oh, okay, close enough. I know we all got good intentions here. Jesus had to physically die to atone for sin, because sin is real. Jesus had to really die. He had to really suffer. And God couldn't say, well, you know, I'm sure we're all trying our best. It's like Jesus had to go and do it. It was a serious work. Okay. Chapter 14, verse 4. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. Now, again, without throwing myself under the bus and you getting all critical of me, I am, like I said last week, I always had the idea that Jesus was going to split the sky and come down to the Mount of Olives. Just like he left, he's going to come back. Again, I'm not saying that's not right. But also, seeing him coming from Edom, is he going to be marching up here, crossing the Jordan, just like he does in Mark chapter 10, we talked about that last night, coming out of through Jericho, going up to the Palm Sunday when he rides in on the donkey that Zechariah talked about. Is he going to follow a similar route when he marches from Edom, having stained his garments blood, and come in here and bring deliverance here? Or does this take place, and then he goes down there and delivers those Jews and comes back? I know. So I'm, you know, if he lands on the Mount of Olives coming out of the sky, that's what I've always taught. I'm considering this could be possible, him coming down in towards Edom and coming up this way. And again, I there's going to be verses that's going to correct me one way or the other, and I just challenge you to keep thinking about that, even if, you know, and, you know, argue one way or the other, because they both can't be true. I mean, he could come down, walk down, come back, and come over. I don't know. Okay. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. Let's just go for comfort's sake that he's going to come out of the sky and land on the Mount of Olives. That's not what I said last week, but it just feels better here. We'll look at it. Now, it says, on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east side. And again, when it says before Jerusalem, it's like in front of, where's in front of Jerusalem? Well, because they were orientated in the ancient world to the east, that is always before. And so that means before. That's like the front side of Jerusalem. And it's very clear, it's on the east side. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half the mountain shall move northward and the other half southward. Now again, I'm not sure how you're going to teach this if you're not going to teach that Jesus, just like he ascended, is going to come back, and this is physically going to happen. I mean, how are you going to allegorize this? And it's like, well, the easiest, clearest way of teaching this is there's going to be an earthquake on the Mount of Olives, and it's going to split in two. It's going to form a valley that's going to be similar to the parting of the Red Sea. Okay, it begins, chapter 14, verse 4. We've been talking about the day for the Lord, a day, you know, the great day of the Lord. Now it says, on that day. On that day, that phrase is used seven times in the book of Zechariah. And that this is one of the reasons why I'm willing to say that the word day here doesn't mean 24 hours. It means an event or a period of time or the sequence of events. Because chapter 14, verse 4, and I've got the seven written down here. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. Verse 6, on that day, there shall be no light, cold, or frost. On that day, living waters shall flow from Jerusalem. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. On that day, a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them, the nations. And on that day, there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. Now, that's definitely in the millennium. I mean, things are set up and everything is marked holy to the Lord. And no longer be a traitor or a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. So they're going to cleanse the temple. They're going to engrave things for the millennial kingdom, and it's all on that day. So again, I'm looking at this more than just, you know, this afternoon the Lord comes back and all these things happen. It happens. And then we mentioned the light. We'll look at this later. No light, cold, or frost. It's going to be set a unique day known to the Lord. And then we go back and we look in Revelation and we see, you know, the stars and the moon and all of these things. It's like, is it day, is it night? What is happening? It's like it's dark, but it's not dark. It's dusk. It's something's taking place. Again, we could talk about it. We read the verses, but that's probably being captured in here also. Mount of Olives. This is the only place Mount of Olives is mentioned in the Old Testament by name, Mount of Olives. Now, New Testament mentions it a couple times. It's referred to in 2 Samuel 15:30. If you remember when Absalom rebelled against David and David was losing the civil war, he had to leave and go down into the Kidron Valley and across and up the Mount of Olives to go hide. That's where it says this in 2 Samuel 15:30. So David went up by the ascent of the Olives. Now, some translations just write in there Mount of Olives, but it doesn't say Mount of Olives. He's going up the ascent, meaning there's an ascent, and it goes through the olive trees. And so it's the ascent through the olives, which is the Mount of Olives. But that's what it is. It doesn't call it the Mount of Olives. It's eventually going to be called. Also, the second, that's when David leaves this way. Interesting. We could say the glory of Israel, the light of Israel, leaves over the Mount of Olives when Absalom's fighting against him. And we already looked at this last week. When the glory in Ezekiel's day leaves, and his vision leaves the temple, here's what it says, Ezekiel 11:23, the glory of Yahweh, this is after he's risen and gone out of the temple, gone out of the city, went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mount, which is on the east side of the city. In some translations just write, Mount of Olives. But it doesn't say Mount of Olives, it says the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. And it says the glory of Yahweh went and stood on this mountain. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, that you've got David leaving this way. You've got Yahweh's glory leaving the temple and going and standing on this mount. You've got Jesus. He could have ascended to heaven a wide variety of places. I mean, he was in Galilee long enough. He could have done it in Galilee. He could have, you know, slipped back on the Temple Mount and went up on the Temple Mount. He could have done it a lot of places. But Jesus ascended very clearly in chapter 1 of Acts from the Mount of Olives. And he went into the clouds, which I don't think you should, you know, just think atmosphere. I mean, maybe there are clouds. But the clouds are a direct connection to Daniel and the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory. Jesus used that very reference that made the high priest tear his garments when Jesus says, you'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory. And the high priest is like, blasphemy! Because Jesus associated himself with that. And then when Luke says he ascended in the clouds, I mean, you can't, oh, well, probably this is a cloudy day. It could have been, and that might be what it means. Luke was saying, yeah, it was cloudy. There's a storm blowing in that day. Or he's connecting Daniel, what was said to the high priest, to Jesus, the Son of Man, ascending, and then he's going to be coming back to this very place, and his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. All of that could be connected, and Jesus is going to come back, Zechariah says, to the Mount of Olives. And again, I've got Acts 1, verse 11 written down there. Chapter 14, verse 5. I already read about the mountain being split. So do this, turn the page, because I did this. Can you see this on page 3? I've got a Google Earth right there. It's drawing something like this. And it's interesting, what I've got circled right there, there's a circle right here. If you look at it, and if you had it on your computer screen, you could zoom in and see it. That's the Temple Mount. And you can see the Dome of the Rock, if you know what I'm talking about. There's a little bubble, little pin right there pointing to the Dome of the Rock. You can actually see it there. Well, in fact, it says, if you can read it, the Dome of the Rock. That's where the temple used to stand. Again, that's debated, but it really shouldn't be because that's the facts. Even that Muslims said that. You know that? Islam said. I've got a book from the 1800s, maybe 1920s. I found it. Someone referred to it in a book I was reading, so I went and found it online and bought a copy. Where it's the Muslim guide. It's a book you would buy probably from the 1920s. The date's obviously in the book. But in the guide, you could buy it on the Temple Mount, and you could go through and read it, and it'd tell you different things. And they say the Muslim, it's the Muslim assembly, the group. I mean, I'm trying to think of what it's called. But it's the leaders of the Muslims. They put this together to hand out. And in the book, it says the Dome of the Rock, which stands where Solomon and Herod's temple, the Temple of Jews, formerly stood. It wasn't until the Zionist movement in 1948 and all this took place where they says, maybe I don't know if you can imagine someone saying something one time and having it like in print and then coming by later and saying something completely different and denying they ever said this. It used to happen in other countries. But anyway, someday, if you can imagine that, if you can imagine, heck, imagine a video and then 2 days later saying, that's not what I said. It's like, well, anyway. But they actually even said, so up until the 1900s, everybody knew, including the Muslims, that's where the temple was. And now today, we're in total confusion. We're in total, oh, well, maybe it's down here in the city of David. Maybe it's over here. It's like, and the Muslims say, it never even existed. It's all fiction. It's like, well, you didn't believe that 80 years ago, and I've got the book. I got the copy. But nonetheless, that's where, and the city of Jerusalem, you could also see it. It's spread out to the north and the south and to the west there. That first little arrow that I've got drawn this way, it looks like this. Oops, how does it look? That's not what it looks like. Right there, that first arrow, that's the Kidron Valley. And then that second arrow, in fact, if you can see it on there, I'm trying to see it, it's written on there. Mount of Olives. The second arrow is pointing right to the word Mount of Olives. Now, the Mount of Olives is about 2.5 miles long. And last week we had a picture of it. You can see there's three peaks. There's three summits on it. It's about 2.5 miles long. And what's amazing, and I try to catch this on here, if you get out there to that last arrow, and if you keep going this way, if you get out over here, it's desert. I mean, it's desert. It's the wilderness of Judea. So if you go up the Mount of Olives and go down the east side of the Mount of Olives, you're going to be out in the wilderness. It's barren land. It's just desert all the way to the Dead Sea. So that's interesting for a couple reasons. When Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane and he wanted to get away, his route of escape is up and over and back to the wilderness, and where'd he go? He's gone. And he's not trapped in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's got the entire Judean wilderness right there, and he survived there for 40 days fasting. And that's where the militaries would go. They'd go out and meet in the wilderness and march on Jerusalem. Okay. The other thing is about that is when we read this, and that's what the white line is, when the Lord's feet are on the Mount of Olives, if he's marching in like he did on Palm Sunday, coming up from Bethphage, coming up and over like this, because that's where Bethphage and Lazarus' tomb is, or where he was raised. Jesus came up and over. That's where he cursed the fig tree and came in. Jesus may come from the wilderness like he came before from Jericho over to this area and up and over, or his feet are going to stand on the Mount of Olives. When that happens, according to Zechariah, there is going to be an earthquake, and I'll show you a little bit about this, an earthquake that was so great that it reminds them of 750 B.C. We studied this when we went through Amos, especially started the book of Amos chapter 1. Verse 1, 750 B.C., when there's an earthquake of Uzziah, and the people fled from that earthquake. Zechariah, they remember that in 518, or whenever Zechariah is writing this portion of the book. There's going to be an earthquake. Now, as you can see on my detailed diagram there, half the mountain is going to move to the north. This 2.5 mile ridge, half it's going to move this way, and half of it's going to move this way, and it's going to form a great valley right here. This is just going to open up like the Red Sea opened up. It's almost like a reenacting of the Red Sea, except it's the Mount of Olives, and there's going to be a valley. Now, there's not 10 to 20 people fleeing. You've got half the city. The remnant is fleeing this way. So it's not like, you know, they're running through this little, it's got to be wide enough for them to flee. And they're going to flee to the east, and they're going to flee to a place called Azel, or Azel, and it's over here. And that's, no one knows where it's at. This word is used once right here. There's no place that matches it. There's no place that ever matches it. It's just, where is it? We just have that word. And so I've got some things written down. Yeah, point one on page three. Azel or Azel. This is the only place this word is used. Some say it relates to the Hebrew word Esel. Okay, and that this is just like someone going, well, how about, does this fit? I don't know if I agree with it. They say it's close to the word Esel. And Esel is a preposition which means beside. So if you'd put that in there, it's going to extend to Azel, which is a form of Esel. Maybe it got spelt wrong or something. It would mean this. Thus, it would mean this. The valley of the mountain shall reach to the side, or beside, or to each side. The valley will reach to each side, or whatever. I mean, it's like, it's more of a description. I don't go with that. It seems like a location. And it is likely this location is large enough to the east to be safe, but also large enough to hold a large amount of people. So, I don't know. If you're looking for prophecy, maybe this is something you're looking for. Maybe it's going to be some kind of a resort. You know, if someone's coming in, the resort of Azel is being put together. It's like, oh, I know what that is. I don't know. But it's a place, and it's going to be big enough for these people to flee. One other thought would be, could this be Petra? And they're going to flee down to Petra. I'm not saying that. Now, point two. We talked about this several years ago when we were going through Amos, but Uzziah's earthquake of 750, they have archaeology, science is amazing. As they excavate down, they go through layers, and they'll get to like a burn layer, and they can date it and stuff, and you know, coins and the position, the type of the pottery, and they can date it. Clearly, this is a burn layer from 586 BC. The coins, the arrowheads, the depth of the burning, the pottery, it all matches, the 500, 600 BC. They have come to, another place they come to would be like walls that have fallen over, maybe because of a war or because of a fire. You can see it fell in. They also find walls, and this has been pretty cool, especially when we were talking in Amos, we talked about this, walls that they're huge stones, and they're in place, except for some reason, at this particular level, they're just moved over. The whole wall is shifted over. Like, what did that? The Babylonians or the Romans or somebody was invading, they would have knocked it over. You're not going to just move a wall over and say, oh, wait a minute, this would be an earthquake that moved it. And then they start looking around and finding other things, and they expect to find at that layer everything to have shown some sign of shaking and being moved. And they have, well, here's archaeologists. This is from the Shiloh excavations, and it's from the Bible Archaeology. You got the website right there. If you go online, you can click on it. It'll be live. But this is, I just copied and pasted this out of that. Archaeologists excavating in Jerusalem near the Temple Mount and a first temple era wall have unearthed evidence of an 8th century BC earthquake. And again, this is scientifically dated. This is not like, Galen's over there speculating. This is scientific research. That'd be seven, you know, mid 8th century, would be 750 BC. The earliest floor of the southernmost room of a building bore evidence of destruction, but not by fire, and was dated to a time period when no known conquest of Jerusalem occurred. So if it's dated 586, that must be the Babylonian invasion. But it's, there's no historical conflict taking place here. Some devastation happened here, but there's no military action. Stones from an upper part of the northern wall had collapsed, shattering a row of vessels that had been along the wall beneath. The excavation directors from Israel Antiquities Authorities, which is a very solid group, believe this corresponds to the great earthquake which occurred in the days of King Uzziah and is mentioned in Amos 1 and Zechariah 14. Now, there's no other record of this. It's just Amos dates his ministry of 2 years before the Uzziah earthquake. He thought, when did I start? I started, it was 2 years before this earthquake came. I told you it was coming. And Zechariah says, you remember, it's going to be an earthquake. Remember they talk about Uzziah's earthquake? That's what this earthquake's going to be like. And you all fled from that. You're going to flee to safety here. Archaeological evidence for Uzziah's earthquake has been found at other sites in Israel, and we talked about that. You can go, and they're not going to mention here, but you can go up further north. In fact, the epicenter, if I remember correctly, was further north. The epicenter was more up in here, and it was just, as it radiated south, it got weaker and weaker. And they've seen it in the Dead Sea. They've seen it at Hazor right here. And they're going to say that right here. Archaeological evidence of Uzziah's earthquake, this 750 BC. It's not just that one place in Jerusalem. They found that one place in Jerusalem after they found all these other places. It's like, look, here it is too. Because that earthquake would have gone across the land. Uzziah's earthquake has been found at other sites in Israel, including Hazor, I just showed you that, Gath, which is over here on the coast by the Philistines. But this is the first time archaeologists have identified evidence of the earthquake in Jerusalem. A similar 8th century destruction layer was noted in a collapsed building 100 meters south of this current dig, which was excavated in the 1970s. But it was not associated at that time with Uzziah's earthquake. But now they're going back and saying, hey, there's a destruction 100 meters south of this. That maybe correlates with this same thing. So nonetheless, that is a historical event. The Bible mentions it. They've got evidence of it across from the Dead Sea going all the way up into Syria. And they get down to a certain layer, they see this earthquake. Anyway, they're referring to, a literal event that is now being duplicated by what I think is going to be a literal event in the future. Going back, this I'm going to read go to page 2. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations. Go to bottom of page 2. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains. Again, I would think flee to the valley of my mountains, this mountain and this mountain now that have been formed. You're going to flee to this valley. For the valley of the mountains shall reach Azel, which apparently is east. Some put it down here in the Kidron Valley. In fact, I've got maps where I've drawn where I place that this is just going to go this way. It's going to open up and go this way. I would change that now, I think. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then my Lord God will come. Now notice right here, interesting, Zechariah personalizes this and says, then, when that happens, then my God will come. Again, once his feet are on the Mount of Olives and this earthquake takes place and the valley's formed, then he says, then my God will come. Now, I would assume that's the Lord, but it's interesting that his feet are on the Mount of Olives and he says, my God will come. Does that mean he's coming into Jerusalem or he's come for his day? But again, Zechariah doesn't just talk about God, but now the God he's writing about, the God he's waiting for, will come. And now here, I'll read this right here. And all the holy ones with him. And again, we've said last week, there's a variety of things that can be. Do I have anything written down on here? No, I don't. Bottom page 3. The holy ones could be believers. It's definitely angels. And then we throw in possibly the group that's come up out of Petra, if they're being led up there. The heaviest evidence is that he's talking about angels. I've got a couple verses right here. Again, holy ones refers to angels. Also, believers can be considered holy ones. But 1 Thessalonians 3:13, may he strengthen your hearts so that you will be blameless and holy in the presence of our God and Father when our Lord Jesus comes with all his holy ones. So he's telling the Thessalonians that they may be found blameless and holy in the presence of God when he comes with all his holy ones. So if they are the holy ones, well, they can't be the holy ones coming with the Lord. There's two groups. They're the holy ones that the Lord is coming with his holy ones to meet them. And Enoch, going way back to the seventh generation from creation, Enoch says, prophesied about them, see, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones. And that leads me now to the back page, and I have tick-tock right here. We've got, I'm going to go to Micah chapter 4, please. I want to read through this at least tonight. Micah chapter 4. And I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to quit. This is a... Micah chapter 4, very quickly, just see if you can find a pattern in this. See if any of these things sound familiar. About the mountain, about the people, about the remnant, about Jerusalem falling, Jerusalem being delivered, entering into some kind of kingdom age. Micah chapter 4, verse 1. I'm going to read 13 verses. And you're on your own. Tony is not here tonight, waving at me. So, no, I'm going to read this and be done. Chapter 14, verse 1. In the last days, that's kind of long, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. Isaiah says the same thing. It will be raised up above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. That's talking about after this event, Jerusalem will be raised up, and people are coming from the nations. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways. Now, this sounds very refreshing. In an age where we are living, where we are getting dumber and dumber, becoming more ignorant and more rebellious every day, and the truth is getting lost. I know you believe in the truth. I know you have the truth. But at the same time, there are things happening that you don't know. I don't know. And we're being told about it through a filtered system that I don't even know what's going on. Yeah, but don't you watch the news? Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't know what's going on. I've got friends. Well, no one knows. And it's going to lead us to the dark ages. It's going to take us into an age of just total confusion. If it's not in this nation only, it's going to be worldwide. And here it is. This will be a great day when the Lord comes, and the nations are going to stream to him because he will teach us his ways. Now, understand. He'll teach us, you know, don't steal, be kind, don't be self-centered. But he's also going to teach us the way the world works, environmentalism. You talk about saving the planet, he's going to tell you how to do it, and it's probably not at all like they're telling you to do it today. I don't know. I'm not that kind of a scientist. But I would guess in this age of deception, whatever they're telling you, here's how you save the planet, is exactly the opposite. That's just me and my attitude. When he comes, Jesus returns, he will teach us how to not just save the planet, but how to make it produce like it's never produced before. So while you're producing, you're also creating more or saving it. And the nation's going to be like, where has this information been? Well, a lot of it's been here, but it's been buried. It's been hidden. But he's also going to bring us revelation that only he knows. He will teach us his ways, which will be morals, but it'll also be scientific, socially, academically, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion. I think you should, again, the law, I think you should think bigger than just the Mosaic law. That it says the law, but I mean, he's going to be more than just bringing us back to the Mosaic law. He's going to be expounding on how to live in a kingdom age called the millennium, where it's going to be crazy production. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now notice right there, Zion and Jerusalem are the same place. So whenever you read Zion, don't always let it go up to heaven. Ah, Zion. Ah, must be in heaven. No, Zion and Jerusalem are synonyms, or Zion is a hill in the city of Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. He's also going to tell them how to live at peace with each other, so both of your economies benefit. They will beat their swords into plowshares, because who wants all these weapons? We're never going to use them when we got to have more agricultural equipment. Right now, we're in an age where we're forsaking agriculture and making more weapons for Ukraine, but I mean, we're making weapons. And their spears into pruning hooks, because they need more agro, because it's production, it's out of control. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Every man will sit under his own vine. That is middle class right there. Every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree. That's what every man wants. I want my own place, my own tree, my own place to go home. I want middle class. And the elites want to destroy that. Jesus is going to bring middle class back and make it universal. Everyone's got their own place. For no one will make them afraid. The elites will not be there. For the Lord Almighty has spoken. All the nations may walk in the name of the Lord, name of their gods. This is now Micah talking about his day. All the nations may walk in the name of their gods, but we today will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. We're going to start walking in his ways today, even before he gets here. Now, you maybe want to walk in your ways of your gods, but eventually you're going to walk in our Lord's ways. We're going to start today. And that's what America originally tried to do. We know the kingdom age is coming, but listen, before it gets here, let's try to establish that kind of principles today. That's why they created the three forms of government, because there's no king here. You needed the priest, the prophet, the judge. Okay. In that day, declares the Lord, I will, watch, are you ready? I will gather the lame and assemble the exiles and those I have brought to grief. I will make the lame a remnant, those driven away by a strong nation. The Lord will rule over them in Mount Zion. That's on earth, I think. From that day and forward, as you, O watchtower of the flock, O stronghold of the daughter of Zion, the former dominion will be restored to you. Kingship will come from the daughter of Jerusalem. Why do you now cry aloud? Have you no king? Has your counselor perished, that pain seizes you like that of a woman in labor? Writhe in agony, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in labor. For now you must leave the city to camp in the open field. You will go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you out of the hand of your enemies. But now, verse 11, but now many nations are gathered against you. They say, let her be defiled. Let our eyes gloat over Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They're coming down to attack Jerusalem, but they do not know what the Lord is doing. They do not understand his plan. This is exactly what we're reading in Zechariah and in Revelation 16. He who gathers them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Oh, come, attack Jerusalem. You don't understand what he's doing. He's bringing you right here to gather you like sheaves. Rise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will give you horns of iron. This is what we saw in Zechariah 12, where all of a sudden, Jerusalem themselves are fighting the enemy. Here, he gathers the nations to Jerusalem, and Israel, or the daughters of Zion, rise up and begins to fight. For I will give you horns of iron, I will give you hooves of bronze, and you will break to pieces many nations. You will devote their ill-gotten gains to the Lord. You'll divide their plunder, their wealth, to the Lord of all the earth. Again, that is when he sets up his kingdom on the earth. So there again, you've got the nations coming to destroy Jerusalem, and all of a sudden, things turning, and Judah, or the people of Jerusalem, fighting back and dividing their plunder, similar to Zechariah, and similar to Zechariah chapter 12, when they start to fight, the tents of David start to fight, and they bring deliverance as they fight with God. Okay, I want to read at least that one. There's other verses there that somehow tie together with this and gives us insight in what we're reading. I'm going to pray, and you're free to go. I do appreciate you being here. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the chance to look into these things. We do ask that we would set our hearts on you, that we would separate ourselves from the ways of the world and begin to understand your ways at this time in history, that we may do the things you've called us to, become the servants you've asked us to be, but also, Lord, that we may share your light, share the truth that we have today, that we're going to walk in your ways today, and we want to share that with others, that they may also find the truth and find life in Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being here.